Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, they help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Their doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true healing starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
On July 11, 1996, the half-naked body of Blair Adams, a 31-year-old Canadian citizen, was found in the parking lot of a construction site in Knoxville, Tennessee. He had been beaten to death, and surrounding him were thousands of dollars in cash, gold, jewelry, and travel documents. Detectives soon learned that in the days leading up to his murder, Blair had been acting strange. He told his friends that someone was trying to kill him, and he needed to get to the United States. Then, without warning, he left Canada, crisscrossing the U.S. border, switching vehicles, buying plane tickets, before finally ending up in Knoxville, a city where he didn't know anyone. But nearly 29 years later, investigators still don't know who killed Blair Adams or why he was in Knoxville in the first place. Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Levasseur. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective. Each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing, whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. All right, so we're going to get into Blair's case in just a couple moments, but I have to address the elephant in the room, my voice. I do not sound very good. I have a stuffy, congested nose, and I feel like we're a family here, and this is the circle of trust, and, you know, I can share everything with you guys, right? So I'm always trying to make sure that I look out for you and I give you some recommendations or advice on how to better protect yourself. Well, I'm going to give you a little something tonight, but it's not how we usually do things. So I've been sick for a little while now. If you listen to Crime Weekly, then you already know this and you might be asking yourself, why is he still sick? It's been a while now. Maybe he should go get checked out. Well, funny story. I do a lot of recording, whether it's on a podcast or on a TV show or on interviews, whatever I'm doing, and I like to have a clear voice. I can hear how terrible I sound. So what I started doing was using Afrin, and there's nothing wrong with Afrin. It's really great. It's a nasal decongestant, but you're only supposed to use it for no more than 3 days. Well, I thought that that was just kind of a guideline, that you could actually use it longer than that. And as long as you were, I guess, not spraying it all day long, you'd be perfectly fine. And I think in the past I've used it for more than 3 days and I have been fine. But I went a little bit overboard this time. I was probably using it for 7 or 8 days in a row, a couple times during the day when I was going to record and then at night so that I could sleep. Well, there is something that can happen when you use Afrin too much. And I now know what that is. It's called rebound congestion. And to basically summarize it, it clears you up and so you can breathe. But when the medication wears off, the congestion can get even worse. And essentially, your body can become dependent on the Afrin. And that's what's happened to me. So my congestion, because I was relying so heavily on the Afrin, has now gotten a lot worse than it ever was because it got used to the Afrin every time I needed it. And so now, in order to rectify the situation, I can't use Afrin at all. There are some other different methods that I found on YouTube, but the main one that I keep seeing is to go just cold turkey, which, if you know me, that's how I like to roll. So unfortunately, I'm going through it right now. It's not going to probably clear up for at least a week or so. And I have a lot of cases to cover. And just like everyone out there who's listening or watching this, sometimes you got to go to work when you're a little under the weather. The unfortunate thing is a main component to my job is my voice. So I do apologize. I hope it doesn't deter people from listening to this episode because my voice is a little raspy. I'm going to do my best to take breaks, drink some water. I have a little vapor stick here that I'm using as well. But under no circumstances will I go to the Afrin. I promise you, you have my word. So again, I apologize. But with that out of the way, let's dive into a little bit about Blair's case. Because if you've listened to Detective Perspective before, which I'm assuming a lot of you have, then this is going to sound similar to a case that I covered in the past, Jack Wheeler. And you're going to see that there are some similarities where Blair is displaying some unusual behavior before his death. And we're going to have to address that and decide whether or not we believe there's a correlation between his behavior leading up to the event. And is that the reason that he's no longer with us? Or, like I had suggested in Jack Wheeler's case, it's just an unfortunate coincidence. So we have a lot to cover. There's some surveillance footage. There's a lot of information to go over, starting in Canada, leading to Knoxville, Tennessee. So with that all out of the way, let's dive into this week's case. Robert Dennis Blair Adams, who went by Blair, was born on December 28, 1964, in Surrey, British Columbia, which is just outside of Vancouver. He was raised in the Surrey area by his mother, Sandra, who described him as kind and ambitious. Many people agreed with her, but others described Blair differently. They said he could be abrasive and confrontational, and that he sometimes got into fights. That may have been due, at least in part, to a period in his life where he struggled with drug and alcohol dependency. During that time, he was also convicted on several charges related to drugs and assault. But in 1994, Blair made a change. He got sober and started going to AA meetings. Then in 1995, he took a job with his stepfather's construction company in Germany. While he was there, he met a woman, and the two began dating. In the late spring of 1996, Blair moved back to Surrey, and as far as I can tell, he started staying with his mom. He continued dating his girlfriend in Germany, and he went to work as a construction foreman. For a while, things seemed to be going well. He had a job he liked, a girlfriend he cared about, and he had been sober for almost 2 years. But in late June of 1996, not long after starting his new job, everything changed. According to those around him, 31-year-old Blair's entire personality seemed to flip. He stopped going to AA, and he started making mistakes at work, including leaving his job site unlocked. And then, out of nowhere, he just quit his new job, a decision that didn't make any sense because just days earlier, he was telling people how excited he was about his new position and how he seemed to be genuinely proud of the opportunity. Around that same time, Blair also began showing signs of paranoia. He told a few close friends that people were, quote, spreading rumors about him, and he believed someone was going to kill him. As the days passed, Blair became increasingly distressed, and his moods began to shift without warning, swinging unpredictably from agitated paranoia to pensive withdrawal. And he stopped sleeping altogether, which obviously is not good when you're mentally struggling. His mother, Sandra, later told Unsolved Mysteries that she had asked him about what was going on, and he responded by saying he didn't think he should tell her about it. Now, she had no idea what it actually meant. And Blair never did tell his mom about what was going on, but he did share some more details with his girlfriend in Germany and one other friend. He said that he believed the men he had worked with in Germany were going to hurt him, and according to Blair, those men recently returned to Canada. Even with all of this completely uncharacteristic behavior, no one close to Blair believed that he was suffering from a mental illness or going through a breakdown, and no one thought that he had relapsed either. So all of this behavior suddenly changing, the people who knew him best, no one could give a clear explanation as to why they thought it happened. Blair's odd behavior continued, and on July 5th, he told his mom that, quote, something was bothering him. That same day, he went to his bank and withdrew all of his savings and also emptied a safety deposit box, taking more than $6,000 in cash and thousands more in jewelry, gold, and platinum with him. Then he drove 4 hours to Courtney to visit his uncle, but when he arrived, the uncle wasn't home. Now, it's unclear why Blair went to see his uncle in the first place or what he did over the next 2 days, but on July 7th, he tried to take a ferry near Courtney to get into Seattle, Washington in his red 1986 Chevy Chevette. According to the Knoxville News Sentinel, Blair was stopped at the border by U.S. immigration officials who were alarmed by the amount of cash he was carrying, and they suspected that he might be trying to smuggle drugs. The officials asked him if he had a criminal record, and he lied and said no, but when they ran his name, they found prior charges related to drugs, so as you would expect, he was denied entry into the United States. Blair reluctantly returned to the Surrey area and visited a few friends. He told at least one of them that he needed to get to the United States because someone in Canada wanted to kill him. Eventually, he made his way back to his mother's house, and according to Sandra, Blair still didn't explain what was going on, but he seemed very nervous and scared, and he didn't want to stay there alone. On July 8th, Blair packed his bags and left his mother's home for the last time. That same day, he went to a travel agency and purchased a round-trip ticket to Frankfurt, Germany, paying around $1,700 in Canadian dollars. It's unclear why Blair booked this flight. His girlfriend, who still lived in Germany, said she had no idea that he was planning to visit. And later that same day, Blair returned to that travel agency and asked them for a refund, and he told them that the person he was going to visit was sick. Now, whether or not he got his money back, it's still unclear, but what we do know is that Blair never went to Germany. According to the Knoxville News Sentinel, on July 9th, Blair was stopped while trying to cross into the United States again, this time at the Pacific Highway border crossing between Surrey and Blaine, Washington. He wasn't in the red Chevette, he was on foot. But this wasn't the only reason he was stopped. See, border officials thought he matched the description of a man suspected of stealing a blue car in Vancouver the day before. The stolen car had been found near the spot where Blair was trying to cross, and a friend of Blair's reported that he had seen Blair driving a blue car. While speaking with the agents, Blair seemed hazy and disoriented, and they noticed he had several small scratches on his arms and legs. When asked about the stolen vehicle, he denied having anything to do with it. As you can probably imagine, agents didn't believe him. However, there wasn't enough evidence to make an arrest, so instead, once again, he was denied entry and sent back to Canada. But as you've probably already put together, Blair was determined to get to the United States. We have a lot more to cover, including looking at some video surveillance footage, talking about some potential DNA, and we're going to get right back into that after this break.
At Ability Chiropractic, they do things differently. They believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Their doctors take time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, they help you restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
Here for the Lowe's early Black Friday deals? You're right on time for some of our biggest savings. We're talking up to 50% off select major appliances, plus up to an extra 25% off when you bundle select major appliances. Holiday lights going up soon? Select ladders are up to 50% off right now. Get Black Friday prices without the Black Friday crowds. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 11/19. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
All right, we're back from break, and later that same day after being turned away from the border, Blair drove to the Vancouver International Airport in his red Chevette, where he left the car behind in a parking lot and then rented a Nissan Altima. After doing that, he used the rental to cross the border into Washington State and drove straight to Seattle. Once he arrived in Seattle, he went to the airport and abandoned the Nissan in the parking lot and bought a one-way ticket to Washington, D.C. According to detectives interviewed by Unsolved Mysteries, The purchase stood out because the one-way ticket cost around $700, while a round-trip flight would have cost only $400. So you could tell he had no intention on coming back and he really wasn't concerned with finances. On the morning of July 10th, Blair landed in Washington, D.C. and went straight to the car rental counter where he picked up a white 1996 Toyota Camry. At around 6:45 a.m., he got behind the wheel and started driving south, heading nearly 500 miles to Knoxville, Tennessee. Now, why he went to Knoxville, it's still a mystery. Blair didn't know anyone there, and no one close to him could think of any reason for him to go. And what made things even more confusing was the route he took. If Knoxville really was the intended destination, why didn't he just fly directly there? Why did he go to Washington, D.C. first? So, yes, these are some of the questions that everyone has, and as we sit here today, we just don't have those answers. By 5:30 p.m., Blair had arrived in Knoxville. He pulled into a gas station on Strawberry Plains Pike and asked the clerk for help, saying that the key to his rental car wasn't working. The clerk then called the Interstate Repair Service, and a man named Gerald Sapp was sent out to assist. Gerald later told the Knoxville News Sentinel that when he arrived, it didn't take long to figure out what the problem was. Blair was trying to use the key from the Nissan he had rented in Seattle, not the Toyota he was driving now. And when Gerald suggested he check his pockets for the right key, Blair refused. Gerald said to him, quote, "If you drove this thing up here, you gotta have another key in your pockets." But Blair wouldn't even look. He insisted that he had the right key in his hand, and it just wasn't working. With Blair refusing to search for the correct key and the rental car company already being closed for the day, there wasn't much that could be done. So Gerald had the Toyota towed to a nearby auto shop and gave Blair a ride to the Fairfield Inn just off Strawberry Plains Pike. Later, Gerald would describe the interaction by saying, quote, "The guy was not all there. He didn't appear to be messed up. He didn't appear to be on drugs, but his mind wasn't functioning correctly for some reason." And I completely agree with everything we know so far. And now we have an independent party saying the same thing. Yes, does Gerald know Blair personally? No, he doesn't, but he doesn't need to. Probably deals with a lot of people in his profession. And for the most part, everyone out there, everyone listening or watching this channel, if you interact with someone, you can usually tell if something's not right. And that's the case here. And you compound that by adding in all the things I've already told you about Blair's behavior and the choices that he made and the routes that he took and just things like refusing to check your pockets. You can clearly see that something is off. At minimum, Blair is not functioning properly or correctly, so this all lines up with what Gerald's telling us. Now, after being dropped off at the Fairfield Inn just before 7 p.m., Blair was seen on surveillance entering and exiting the lobby of the hotel multiple times. And over the next 40 minutes or so, he paced in and out of the lobby five separate times before finally approaching the front desk to reserve a room. And you can see it on the surveillance footage here. It's kind of a little choppy, but you can see he's just walking in and out, not really interacting with anyone for a while. Again, almost 40 minutes. And then finally he approaches the counter. So he approaches the clerk, he reserves the room, and he pays for the room with a $100 bill, but he doesn't even collect the change. He just gets his hotel room key card, puts it in his pocket, and walks back out of the lobby out of the hotel at 7:37 p.m. After walking out of the hotel lobby, Blair was never verifiably seen again. And I say verifiably seen again because there were a few potential sightings of Blair after he left, but investigators later ruled them out. And you can look them up. They're all over the internet. There was one that described him, and there was another description taken of him. But as the process went through and investigators actually vetted those leads, they turned out not to be accurate. So I didn't want to include them here by throwing in red herrings. I didn't think it was necessary. I wanted to go with all the facts that I could. Now, the next morning, on July 11th, at around 7:15 a.m., two construction workers arrived at a site of a new hotel under construction at 7471 Crosswood Boulevard. And it's important to note that this location was just off Strawberry Plains Pike, not far from the Fairfield Inn where Blair had just reserved a room. When these construction workers pulled into the lot, they discovered the half-naked, brutally beaten body of Blair Adams. They immediately called the police, and after detectives arrived, they started processing one of the most bizarre crime scenes they had ever encountered. Blair was only wearing a torn shirt, and it was immediately clear that he'd been murdered, but investigators wouldn't know how he was killed until the autopsy was performed. Okay, as far as this crime scene, let's break down exactly what detectives saw at the scene when they arrived, and you can come to your own conclusions. So, one detective said Blair's belongings, quote, were strewn about 100 yards from his body, like they had been thrown from a vehicle as it was moving. The belongings included Blair's pants, socks, a hotel key card, and multiple forms of ID, including his driver's license, passport, and credit card. One of his shoes was lying amongst his belongings, while the other was underneath his head, as though he was using it as a pillow, which obviously we know he was not doing that, but I only say that so you have an accurate visualization of what it looked like. It almost looked like he was laying on it. Also found nearby was his car keys, including the key from the white Toyota Camry he had rented in DC and the key from the Nissan he had left in Seattle. Now, according to Unsolved Mysteries, one of the most striking details was the condition of Blair's pants. They had been turned inside out, which led detectives to believe that they were pulled off by someone else. Now, I understand the rationale. Yeah, they definitely could have been pulled off by someone else, but I'd be lying to you if I told you that I've never pulled off my pants, and upon doing so, they were inside out. It easily could have been done by Blair. So I don't think this was the most glaring or striking detail as far as what I can tell. And again, that's coming from Unsolved Mysteries, so I don't even know if that was the most striking detail to law enforcement. It may have just been lost in transition. But I don't really take a lot from the pants being inside out. There's a lot of things that could explain that. It could have been him. It could have been someone else. They also could have came off that way if they had been unbuttoned and then there was some type of struggle. And maybe as he was being thrown from a vehicle, they were kind of dragged a little bit and turned inside out the rest of the way. There's a lot of explanations. I don't look at that detail and think of it as a smoking gun. To me, what's more important is the fact that there was a lot of money. As I mentioned earlier, Blair had emptied his entire savings account, and when he was found, around Blair's body and in his pockets, law enforcement found roughly $4,000 in cash. So not the quite $2,000 that he had when he emptied the account, but pretty damn close to it. And if you think about all the travel he did, it would make sense, especially if he was paying for everything in cash. And this was a mix of Canadian, American, and German currency, which also makes sense. He originally withdrew the money from Canada, and then he crosses over the border and probably exchanges some of it for U.S. currency, and he may have already had German currency on him. He had been there before, he lived there, he had a girlfriend there, may have had plans to go back, so if he's traveling to the U.S., he might have taken everything that he had with him. What's interesting is that we don't know the denominations, and if I had to guess, I would say the majority of that $4,000 was in Canadian currency, but again, we don't know. My big takeaway is we know he started with at least $6,000, at least, maybe a little bit more. I don't know how he paid for the cars. I don't know how he paid for his gas and food and all those expenses. But based on the price of things 30 years ago, $2,000, a lot of money. So did he genuinely spend $2,000 or was there some actual cash missing, which may indicate that this was a robbery, even though the experts and the investigators in this case don't believe that's the scenario, but we'll save that. Now, in addition to the money, nearby, detectives also found a duffel bag containing maps and various travel receipts, including his plane ticket and documentation for the rental cars. There was also a black fanny pack, unzipped, that contained nearly 5 ounces of gold bars, gold and platinum coins, jewelry, keys, and a pair of sunglasses. Altogether, those items were estimated to be worth around $2,000. That's a lot of money, and as far as the gold and silver and platinum coins are concerned, you could take that pretty easily and it would be hard to trace. So the fact that it was still there is extremely interesting. Based on what detectives found at the scene, investigators didn't believe robbery was the motive for Blair's murder. But as one detective later told WBIR, quote, they could have taken something I don't know about. They could have taken his pocket money thinking that was it, or got scared all of a sudden and took off. It was probably dark, so they couldn't see what they had anyhow. And this is a very plausible explanation. You know, it's not like the movies. It was very dark outside. This is all going down in a matter of seconds. And so in a haste to get out of there before being seen, they might have missed some things. But as the detective pointed out, we don't know what else Blair was carrying. He may have had something of value that the perpetrator or perpetrators found, took it, and left everything else behind. I also want to throw out there, and I was going to save it for the perspective, but I'll say it now. There's also a possibility that maybe things got out of hand and it resulted in Blair's death. And when they realized what had happened, they didn't want anything associated with him. They didn't want to run the risk of being caught with one of his items that could be tracked back to Blair, which could then link them to a murder. And I've seen that before where it's all right there in front of them, but they choose to dump whatever they found because they know that if they're found with those items, it's not just going to be for robbery. Now they're going down for murder. And sometimes a couple $1,000 in cash or some gold is not worth that risk, even to the most heinous criminals. There's also another angle here that we have to explore, and that's the possibility that this wasn't financially motivated. And we're going to discuss that more in a few minutes. Now, after processing all of this evidence at the crime scene, detectives decided to expand their search and canvass the area, hoping to find out more information. And as they spoke to people, they learned that at around 3:30 a.m. on the morning of July 11th, a security guard working at a nearby business heard someone scream. Now, at the time, the security guard believed it came from a woman, but investigators now believe that scream came from Blair and that it represents the moment he had been killed. An autopsy would later reveal that Blair, who had no drugs or alcohol in his system, had been beaten, and he had died from a powerful blow to his stomach. The impact caused his stomach to rupture, leading to septic shock. His body also showed signs of some other serious injuries, including a cut on his forehead, which medical examiners believed may have been caused by a weapon, possibly something like a club or a crowbar. I personally would also throw in a gun. I've seen injuries in the past where they look like a split, like something from a bat or a club, but in reality, they were just struck in the head with the butt of a gun. So I would throw that in there too, because if we think about control and something that may have happened before Blair was killed, what if he was robbed at gunpoint? I'm just throwing that in there as well. Now, in addition to these injuries, there were also signs that Blair had fought back. Chunks of his hair were missing from his head, and he had blood on his hands. One of his hands had a deep cut, and it was badly bruised as if it had been, quote, forcefully knocked to the pavement. It's also worth noting that he had road rash, which I'm going to bring up in my perspective. And in addition to all of that, Blair's body also showed signs of sexual assault, although no DNA was present. And officials were unable to determine if the assault had taken place before, during, or after his murder. Based on the condition of Blair's body, particularly the fact that he wasn't wearing pants and there were signs of sexual assault, investigators developed a theory that his murder may have been the result of a sexual encounter gone wrong. There was a truck stop nearby, not the one that Blair had met Gerald Sapp at, but another location just off the highway that was known for sex work. David Davenport, the chief of the Knox County Sheriff's Office Cold Case Unit, told the Knoxville News Sentinel, quote, Blair could have started the act with a male sex worker and never did it and got rolled. Or maybe it was a female sex worker. Maybe she had a pimp that was close by and they were going to roll this guy and they got scared and didn't. Davenport also believes the encounter took place in a car. He theorized that something went wrong, Blair was attacked, and then thrown out of the vehicle. He said he believes that Blair was then struck by the bumper of the car, which caused the fatal injury. Sheriff Jimmy Jones, on the other hand, he believes that Blair's fatal injury was caused by a kick to the stomach. But either way, both men agreed something terrible happened to Blair. Yeah, we know. If I had to choose here, I actually tend to lean towards Davenport. Yes, you could have been kicked in the stomach and it could have been hard enough where it could kill you. I would like people to show me how often that happens. I've had a lot, hundreds, maybe thousands of cases where people were jumped, beaten, robbed, and they were kicked in the face, kicked in the stomach. And I've never in my almost 20 years of investigations at this point had someone die from a kick to the stomach. Now, maybe that just means that's just one of the things that I haven't experienced. And maybe there's other investigators or other attorneys who watch or listen to this who need to get in my comments right now and tell me, hey, it happens all the time. Or maybe it's just someone out there who's had personal experiences with this. Maybe you work at a hospital where these injuries are the result of someone kicking them. Now, conversely, how many times have we had someone hit by a car and on the exterior, it doesn't look like they should die from their injuries, but because of the internal injuries to the heart, to the chest, to the stomach, to whatever part of their body, they die. So that's why I'm leaning that way, that it would be easier to understand how Blair died from a blow to the stomach if it was caused by a moving vehicle. And I do think that Davenport is onto something here. More than likely, whatever happened started in a vehicle. And as I mentioned a little while ago, Blair did have some road rash. So could something have started in the car, they went wrong, and as Blair gets thrown from the car, the person who's driving the vehicle intentionally or accidentally strikes Blair. And upon doing so, they realize what they've done, and now they dump everything else that was still in the vehicle because they know it could come back on them. Or, as some have alluded to, the motive of the crime itself was not financial in nature. It was sexual in nature. So when that was done, whatever items were left behind of value, it didn't matter to the offender. So they got rid of them. And I know I said a little while ago I was going to save that for the perspective, but that's the point to mention it. That's where it makes the most sense because even the investigators that have worked the case can't agree. So if I'm sitting here based on what I know up to this point, based on the research that I've done, I tend to lean towards a vehicle causing those injuries. But pause this video right now, whether you're on the podcast form or on the actual YouTube video, take a second, comment down below. Let me know what you think up to this point. Vehicle or a foot? What do you think caused those injuries? Now, after the autopsy was complete, investigators went back to the construction site to search for possible weapons. They searched the area for anything that might have been used to beat Blair, including pieces of rebar from the site. And they tested several items to see if they matched his injuries or carried his DNA, but none of them did. So good on them for doing that because that could have answered a lot of questions, but unfortunately, no leads there. But this is definitely something that needed to be done. Now, speaking of DNA, one thing that I intentionally left out when describing what was found at the crime scene initially was a piece of DNA. And the reason I left it out is because I wanted to save it for now because I think it's critical to this case. And that piece of DNA involved a long strand of hair that was found in Blair's hand. Now, testing later confirmed that the hair belonged to someone else other than Blair, but the identity of that person is still unknown. And over the years, investigators have been able to extract enough DNA to run tests, but so far there have been no matches. However, we do know one person who was definitively ruled out through DNA testing, Gerald Sapp, the man from the Interstate Repair Service who had interacted with Blair on July 10th after the incident with the car key. And this is something that should have been fully expected, with Gerald being one of the last people to see Blair alive and maybe having some type of indication as to what Blair had in his possession. Of course, investigators are going to look into him. So they questioned him, they collected his hair samples, but the DNA from the hair found in Blair's hand did not match. And that's obviously a good thing for Gerald. I will say, I would still keep Gerald on the radar as far as someone to go back and talk to later, because maybe there was a conversation, maybe there was something between Blair and Gerald that Gerald didn't think was important at the time. Did Blair ask for recommendations of places to go, or if he wanted to find a strip club or where sex workers could be, what's some spots that he should hit? I think detectives probably ask these questions, but you never know. Gerald is definitely someone I'd be keeping on the Rolodex if I'm the investigator in this case, and I'd randomly give him a call here and there and just ask him to maybe repeat the conversation that transpired on the drive from where Gerald first interacted with Blair to dropping him off at the Fairfield Inn. It can't hurt. You might as well do it. Take a quick recording as long as Gerald's cool with it, just to make sure it continues to match up. But with Gerald in the clear and no solid leads in Tennessee, Detectives tried to retrace Blair's steps from Canada, hoping to figure out what he had brought with him to Knoxville in the first place. According to the Knoxville News Sentinel, they learned about Blair's erratic behavior in the days leading up to his death, but despite their best efforts, they were never able to determine why he had come to Tennessee. By the time the initial investigation was complete, detectives were left with more questions than answers. They told Unsolved Mysteries that the entire case was baffling and that there was, quote, no logical explanation for anything Blair did. They had no motive for murder, no explanation as to why he left Canada in the first place, and no reason for why he went to the hotel construction site. The investigation continued, but there were very few leads and no major developments. And one detective even said later that they never received a single credible tip about Blair's murder. Then in 2017, 21 years after Blair was killed, his mother Sandra spoke with the Knoxville News Sentinel for a phone interview and revealed something she had never shared with the police. She said the real reason Blair left Canada for the United States was because he planned to attend the 1996 Summer Olympic Games in Atlanta, which were set to begin on July 19th. Now, Sandra never explained why she kept that information from investigators. She simply said, quote, that was the whole point of his trip, and then she hung up the phone. Now, your guess is as good as mine as to why, if that's the truth, she didn't relay that information to law enforcement. There's a part of me as a parent that believes maybe she heard all the rumors and some of the disparaging things that were being said about her son. And although he may not have said that to her, she decided in a last-ditch effort after 20 years to try and change the narrative, to maybe spin it in a more positive light, to say, hey, listen, he was coherent, he was aware of what he was doing, he told me what he was doing, and he was going to the Olympics. And unfortunately, something bad happened to him. Because I just really can't come up with a viable reason why she wouldn't relay that information to law enforcement. It doesn't make him look bad, it's not incriminating, and it may have helped solve his case. So, I don't know. I don't know what to think here. That's what my gut tells me. What are you guys thinking? Do you agree, or do you think there could be something to this? And if you do think that's the case, if you think she's telling the truth, why do you think that she never told law enforcement? And I will say one more thing about this whole Olympics twist. Police later said that they were never able to prove that Blair was planning to attend the Olympics. And so take that for what you will. I don't know how in depth they looked into it, but I would assume if he was planning on going to the Olympics, something in his bags or in his fanny pack or amongst his belongings would have suggested that he was looking into it, excited about it, maybe searching it somewhere, maybe some pamphlets, something. And apparently there was nothing. And I would have loved to have talked to Sandra and asked her why she decided not to tell law enforcement if this was in fact what happened. But unfortunately, 3 years after that call, Sandra passed away, never knowing what happened to her son. And unfortunately, that is the last known update we have in this bizarre case. Blair's murder remains unsolved, and his loved ones are still desperate for answers.
Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, they help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Their doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true healing starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at AbilityChiro.com.
Here for the Lowe's early Black Friday deals? You're right on time for some of our biggest savings. We're talking up to 50% off select major appliances, plus up to an extra 25% off when you bundle select major appliances. Holiday lights going up soon? Select ladders are up to 50% off right now. Get Black Friday prices without the Black Friday crowds. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 11/19. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
All right, let's dive into this perspective. And as I mentioned at the very top of the show, this case does have some similarities to Jack Wheeler. And with Blair's case, you appear to have someone on the surface who's experiencing some type of mental distress. There's a series of events that unfold, which ultimately result in their murder. And the first thing I want to address is, I'm sure a lot of you feel the way I feel, where it does appear that he was going through something. What that was, we may never know. but there was something going on and his brain was playing tricks on him. It wasn't actually occurring the way he had perceived it, but we do have to acknowledge the fact that there is a scenario, however unlikely it may be, where the paranoia that Blair was experiencing and the things he was saying to other people was warranted and it was justified. And there was somebody actually tracking him down. And there was someone who wanted to hurt and kill him. And that person or persons may have exactly done that. They may have tracked him down. How they would have done that, I don't know. There's no connection between Blair and Knoxville, Tennessee. But somehow, maybe, in the most unlikely situation possible, this person or people followed him down south and they finally caught up with him. Do I think that's what happened? No, I do not. But I would not be a good investigator if I didn't at least throw it out there. There's nothing definitive that rules it out. So in good conscience, I can't say with 100% certainty that that's not what happened. But I do think there's more plausible scenarios, and that's what we're going to talk about. Which brings me back to what I believe is most likely. Something happened to Blair while he was still in Canada. I don't know what that is. I'm not a doctor. But it caused him to have this paranoia over something that wasn't actually happened. And for whatever reason, he felt like he would be safer in the United States. And maybe there is some truth to what Sandra said. Maybe he had alluded to her that he was potentially going to go down to the Olympics while he was in the USA. And that could still be true. He went to Tennessee. Maybe the plan was to stop there and then make his way to Atlanta. But let's go with what we do know. We have that video. We could throw it up again right here. It looks like he has that duffel bag kind of over his shoulder. He may already have the fanny pack on because his shirt is kind of untucked, so we can't really see it. Or maybe the fanny pack is inside the duffel bag. We don't know. But you can clearly see he's going in and out of the hotel, never goes up to the room. So either he's thinking someone's following him, he's waiting for someone, or he's looking for something. And then he finally leaves the hotel at 7:37 p.m., and he's not seen again until the construction workers find him. But I want to focus on the 3:30 a.m. scream, because if that's accurate, that still means that it was a decent amount of time that went by between 7:30 and 3:30 a.m. So where did Blair go? Who was he with? And I want to throw this out there. Although investigators said they believed that scream was from Blair, the security guard said it was from a woman. And why can't it still be a woman who was potentially with Blair when something happened to him? Why are we not talking about that? Either way, I do think the 3:30 a.m. scream is significant and more than likely related to when whatever happened to Blair occurred. So what did happen to Blair? There's many possibilities. He wasn't behaving like himself. He may have been just walking through a not so great area. Some people may have took notice of him and his duffel bag and decided to stop him. Maybe they robbed him and maybe he put up a fight. And during that fight, things got bad and he was struck in the stomach by a foot or by a car and he was killed. And because he was killed, even though the original motive was financial in nature, the offender or offenders decided not to take anything, even though they may have already thrown it in their car, because they knew that could potentially connect them back to a murder. Completely possible. Another scenario is that Blair was over there. Maybe he was looking for something. I'm not going to speculate whether it was a male sex worker or a female sex worker. To me, it's kind of irrelevant, although I will say one thing that stood out to me. And all the women that watch this video, please weigh in on this part. Tell me if I'm off. I do find it interesting that chunks of his hair were missing. Not typically what you see in a guy-on-guy fight. That's just my opinion. In my experience over the years, when it comes to women, they immediately go for the hair. So if Blair was in an altercation with a woman, maybe she started grabbing at his hair. Maybe he started grabbing at her hair, and that's why you hear the woman scream. And if that is the case, well, who is this woman? Well, based on what we know about the area and what law enforcement has told us, more than likely it would be someone who's potentially involved in sex work. So Blair could have been down there. Maybe he was looking for something, or maybe he was just interacting with this person and they told him, hey, get in the car. We can hang out. They get in the car. And once they do, Blair realizes that this person's trying to rob him or take stuff from him. Things go south and maybe there's an argument or an altercation between the two of them. And that's all that it is. Or maybe, like law enforcement has suggested, there is a pimp nearby who gets involved, gets into the car. The fight escalates eventually because maybe Blair's pants are already unbuttoned. He's thrown from the car. His pants are inside out. His shoes are all over the place. And as the offender or offenders are driving away, they strike Blair intentionally, accidentally. Who knows? Doesn't matter. They did. And when they realize that they did, again, knowing these items in the car could link back to them, they throw them from the car as they flee the area. To me, that is the most likely scenario. Based on the evidence that we do have, that's where most of the pieces line up the best. The long hair in the hand, the chunks of hair missing from Blair's head, the road rash, the way it all went down, the fact that his stuff was kind of scattered 100 yards away from each other, so that would suggest a car, the area in which he was found, all of that, it aligns. The only thing that gives me pause is the fact that we're being told he had injuries that suggested sexual assault. I don't know what those injuries are, so it's hard for me to elaborate on that, but just let's play it out. First off, let me say tractor trailer drivers, they're the unsung heroes. They're the people that really make this whole country work. They're delivering everything you can think of all hours of the day while we sleep, while we work, while we're with our families. They're driving throughout the country. It's one of probably the most difficult jobs to have. You're alone a lot. You don't get a lot of sleep. You're kind of the unsung hero because you never get the thanks you deserve. So I appreciate what you guys do. And I know you get paid pretty well, but you deserve even more. That being said, in this particular scenario, if we're to imagine a world where a tractor trailer driver was involved, it could make sense why this is unsolved. One advantage to being a tractor trailer driver is the fact that you're traveling throughout the country and you're not in one place for an extended period of time. So if you're a truck driver and you're looking for something, potentially a sex worker, and you're in this area and you spot Blair kind of wandering around aimlessly, not really knowing where he is, and you see this big duffel bag, maybe you think, hey, I'm going to invite him into the cab of my truck. I'm going to take advantage of him, and then I'm going to get rid of him. So once he gets Blair in the truck, I don't know how they would do this, but they get him in. They're having a conversation. The driver attacks him, maybe assaults him right there as they're in the cab of the truck. There's a fight during this whole process. That's where the chunks of hair come into play. And then after that happens, while still in the cab of the truck, that's when the driver strikes Blair in the stomach, maybe with the same item that he strikes him in the head with. And after doing so, he throws him out of the truck. He speeds off, throwing Blair's remaining items out of the cab. I'm throwing this out there. I'm saying it to you. I can't lie to you. It doesn't align for me. It doesn't make a lot of sense. I still think the scenario regarding a potential sex worker inside a regular vehicle is the more than likely scenario. But again, I'm trying to put all options out there because it's important, even though I may not believe in it, to give a full perspective and allow you guys to come to your own conclusions. So where does that leave us? We're almost 30 years into this one, still no answers. I have to tell you, I still have hope. Why? You know why. We have DNA. And DNA is literally changing the true crime landscape. We're able to solve cases 30, 40 years old, even longer. We solved the case 60 years old for criminal coffee because of DNA. So is it possible with this DNA that we could potentially solve this case? Absolutely. So my number one question would be simple to law enforcement. I know you've tried matching it to people before, but are you doing like individual matches based on persons of interest? Have you uploaded that DNA into CODIS? Have you uploaded that data into ancestral databases where you can potentially get a familial match, right? We may not have the suspect's DNA, but maybe we have a brother or a sister or a cousin or an uncle from the Knoxville, Tennessee area where you say, okay, let's go to that person. Let's get a list of their relatives and let's see who was in Knoxville, Tennessee when the murder occurred. You're going to get a list. Once you get that list, then you run the criminal records of those individuals. Do any of them have charges that involve sex work? If so, you go to that person, you get a swab of their DNA, and you compare it to what you have. And just like that, you can solve a cold case. I know I make it sound simple, but I've seen the work that these genetic genealogists can do. All they need is one match, and it doesn't even have to be that close. Just give them something, and they'll follow the breadcrumbs. I have two guys, I'm going to give them a shout out, Jeremy and Ryan. They're awesome. They work for Break. They're solving cases all the time, and they love this work. Not only do they work for me, but they also volunteer for other organizations because they love what they do. So just give them something. Just give them a chance, upload it into GEDmatch or something similar, and let them see what they can do. You have nothing to lose and everything to gain. I hope that has already been done, and we're just waiting for someone to be uploaded that gives us a start. But at the same time, I'm kind of hoping they haven't, because if that's the case, that means we got a really good chance of solving this one. And the reason that I'm so high on the DNA in this case is because unfortunately there may only be one offender. And if that's the case, they're going to go to their grave with this information. We're never going to find them. And if they didn't tell anyone what happened, how can we really get to the root of the issue? But maybe they were stupid. Maybe they had a bad night and they had a couple drinks and they decided to spout off some information, or they confided in a family member or friend many years ago and that person just didn't feel like they could come forward at the time, but maybe they want to now. So just to recap, Blair Adams was last seen on surveillance footage at 7:37 p.m. on July 10th, 1996, walking out of the Fairfield Inn lobby in Knoxville, Tennessee, just off Strawberry Plains Pike. Early the next morning, his body was found in a parking lot of a nearby construction site, and he had been brutally beaten. Anyone with information in this case should contact the Knox County Sheriff's Office at 865-215-2243. And just a quick side note here, if anyone from the Knox County Sheriff's Office is listening or watching this video, and maybe you haven't done some of the things I've suggested, you can go out there and do it. But if it's a case where you don't know where to start or you need some finances to facilitate it, reach out to me. It can remain confidential. I just want to help. I just want answers for Blair's family. So if you need to be pointed in the right direction about the process, or you would like my team to do the IGG work, we'll gladly do it. It won't cost you a thing. Just reach out to me. I'm easy to find. My final words, as always, go out to the friends and family of Blair. Unfortunately, Sandra is no longer with us, but that doesn't mean we should stop fighting for Blair, and it doesn't mean we should stop fighting for her. So we're going to continue to do so. I'm really optimistic about this case, and I'm hoping that I have an update for you soon, and we finally have the people who are responsible for this heinous crime. Until then, everyone stay safe out there, and I apologize again for the congestion if you made it through this entire episode. What do we want to do for an emoji in this one? Prayer hands? Prayer hands because you're all saints, you're all angels for sticking with me, even though I'm sure some of you said, yep, nope, hard pass. But yes, prayer hands in the comment section if you stuck with me the entire time, because you are my guardian angels. I do not deserve you, and I greatly appreciate you. Everyone stay safe out there. I'll see you next week, and hopefully I don't sound like this. Have a good night.
Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, they help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Their doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true healing starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.